Right now it's time for none other than the panel of politicians to put their gears in motion as we open up to First Sunday Politics. And they're here. We're changing the name of this segment, by the way. No longer is it going to be the roundtable, First Sunday Roundtable political debate. In order to keep control, we thought we would just call it First Sunday Politics. Our slew of producers across the country came up with this idea. Good morning, everybody, and may I introduce our guests, of course, if I can only find my script here. I don't know any. Jim Parmalee.
Good morning. Thanks for having us again.
Mr. Parmalee is head of the GOP.com, Northern Virginia. He is strictly a Republican. You should not say that. I'll get a call. Nick Sawalk, the Libertarian.
Thank you. Morning, Jim. Or Jerry. Whoa. He's next to me.
And what's this T-shirt you have? It says Libertarian.
No, you don't have to read my T-shirt on the air, Jerry.
A noun. Gun-toting economics.
Economist on drugs.
Oh, economist on drugs.
It's a joke.
I couldn't see it too well. All right, moving right along, we have Emily Leffler, who is an independent, whatever that means.
Good morning, Jerry.
Thank you very much. And Eric Michaels of the Green Party.
Hey, how's it going, Jerry?
Fine. What happened to Ralph Nader? He kind of got beat up there a couple of weeks ago, didn't he?
Got a pie in the face while endorsing the other candidate.
He didn't like that. He didn't like pie or something?
No, somebody thinks it's their idea of a joke to go around pieing.
Well, what about
Schwarzenegger got egg.
Schwarzenegger got egg.
Cool.
Right, the politicians are really catching
it. It's free food.
Excuse me, everybody. We welcome to our panel. Finally, we got a Democrat on the panel. I mean, months of searching?
They just were afraid to come. She's a brave lady.
Patrice McKinney, Democrat. Patrice, I understand you do work with the National Democratic Headquarters or the committee?
No, I'm not working with the National
Democratic. But you're an attorney, though.
I'm an attorney, yes.
I'm glad of that because we have to keep some people in line around here. Anyway, welcome to First Sunday Politics, guys. Let's get started. We got a lot of topics. Our telephone number 301-230-0980, pound 980 on Verizon Wireless System. Our lines are open. A lot of topics out of the summer. One, of course, has to do with the Democrats. In the spotlight, they have, 9, 10 people running for against George Bush. The question that enters here is, can they beat George Bush with his purse, his money purse? Can they beat him because although CNN polls show his popularity has decreased a little bit, but he's still popular. And if the Democrats can't find a candidate that can beat him, do you think Hillary Clinton will become the wild card, or do you think that in the very last minute she could be drafted from the 2004 convention? Anyway, I'm going to turn to you, Patrice, and give you the honors first. What about the Democrats?
Thank you, Jerry. Well, as far as the Democrats go, George Bush, I think, may be handing it over to them. Yesterday, the Zagat polls came out, and his popularity is now, for the first time, under 50%. 52% of Americans think that he could and should be replaced.
But one could say polls are up and down. I mean, that is not really a certainty that he's under losing popularity or losing control?
I would say that there's never any certainty in politics or in the polls. However, his popularity has declined consistently since early this year. I believe in the spring he was over 70%.
What's behind the loss? Why?
I think that it's the American people are increasingly dissatisfied with the way all of the policies are going, really. The war in Iraq, the economy, everything seems to be declining. There doesn't seem to be much hope or optimism that things are going to be getting better anytime soon.
It's obvious that I would turn to Jim Parmalee, the Republican, to answer to this. But before I do, I'll go to the Libertarian in all fairness. And my dear buddy over there, what do you think about this, with his popularity dwindling and the Democrats feel that they have a shoe in? Nick?
I don't think anyone has a shoe in right now. I think that it is nice to see this many Democratic contenders because we are getting a broad spectrum of that side of the political debate. But really, it's a question of who's going to take us into deficits to do what? The Bush is going to take us into deficits to blow up other countries. The Democrats are going to take us into deficits for single payer health care. So it's all just the same mouthful of mouthwash, swishing back and forth. One side to the other. I don't think that Hillary Clinton will be drafted. She is still political plutonium, and a national level will not fly in the heartland.
Okay, let's turn to Eric for that.
Well, I have to comment on a couple of little things that Nicholas said. Well, I agree that Bush and the Republicans would be certain to take us into a deficit over the military spending and whatnot. And, you know, I think maybe the point Nick is trying to make that Democrats are more likely to spend money on domestic issues. The single-payer health care system actually would save us money, Nicholas. But anyways, I think that, you know, I think that the issue is... The Democrats, especially folks like Howard Dean and Dennis Kucinich, I think are really taking advantage of a lot of the misgivings that people have about the Bush administration, about the fact that it has mishandled both domestic and foreign policy wildly, has, you know, really left a lot of people with a sense of despair at home, shipped millions of jobs overseas, and, you know, has alienated us from the world community.
Emily.
Well, I think that Howard Dean has been showing a lot of promise. He's risen to the forefront over the last month or so, raising an incredible amount of money from grassroots methods on the internet. Then John Kerry announced his candidacy, and he's been in the forefront. So it seems the two of those are leading the pack at this point. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And I've also been reading a lot about an effort to draft Wesley Clark to run. So... that could be another last-minute jump in on the race.
Our telephone number, 301-230-0980, pound 980, in the Verizon Wireless System. Ladies and gentlemen, the one Republican who speaks for them all, and that is Jim Homily.
Now you're really going to get some phone calls. Let me just respond to Patrice's poll. I guess any port in a storm, I mean, right. the Democrats are desperately looking for some numbers that show that they can win.
Mm-hmm.
The same poll that she's quoting so hopefully goes further and says, if you were to vote today, would you vote for George Bush or Dean? Would you vote for George Bush or Kerry? In all of those matchups, George Bush wins significantly. So I think that is really the main strength. And I think Howard Dean has a shot at getting the nomination. He's passionate. He's wrong, but he's passionate.
What do you mean he's wrong?
He's wrong on the issues. He's out of step. He's out of step with a lot of folks. Out of step with the mainstream of America, but he's very passionate. The people who vote in Democratic primaries, any party activist is going to be more passionate about those things.
But you know one thing I can't understand, when you say he's out of step with mainstream America, it's like the polls, like I hear a lot of the parties, Democrats and Republicans, not so much the other parties like the Green Party and the Libertarians or even an independent, but I hear the two major parties always saying, this is what the American people want. Would you please explain to me where this comes from? Who are the American people?
Well,
the majority that voted for George Bush.
Oh, what? Yeah.
The majority voted for Al Gore.
That's only one.
Okay, Patrice.
In terms of mainstream America, as you all know, Howard Dean just had his Sleepless Summer tour, and at every stop across the way, he drew between 5,000 and 15,000 people. I would say they represent mainstream America.
Okay. If you're just joining us, here we are with our first Sunday Politics, and the gang is here. Our telephone number, 301-230-0980, pound 980, the Verizon Wireless System, absolutely free call. A lot of the issues that we're discussing are the issues that have actually come out of the summer, and this is going to be a high-profile political year with the presidential race coming up, what's happening in California, and also what's happening locally. Eric, sorry. Yes.
I'm Nick these
Nick,
days.
There you go.
What's up with Kerry? I mean, this man is running to divest himself of any strong position on any issue. And not that, you know, that's not generally good political strategy, but there's no vision in that man. At least Howard Dean is right on one of the issues. He's right on the war. And he's inspiring people. And I don't see that from Kerry.
Why is he right on the war?
Because the war was wrong.
I mean, that's a nice answer.
Okay, because we have no weapons of mass destruction, because we haven't caught Al-Qaeda, because we spent thousands of dollars and thousands of billions of dollars and thousands of lives fighting a war that has shown absolutely nothing more than another Vietnam, and because we're risking, you know, our family's lives, my family at least in the military, to go and fight this war that... we have no justification for.
Jim and Eric, let me ask you. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, is in Iraq this weekend. He says that thanks to the American the efforts of America, it's a better nation. The people of Iraq are seeing a better time right now. Yet the great criticism comes out of the Democratic camp and other camps also that it's a snafu. It really just has just fallen apart, the post-war in Iraq.
Well, certainly, you know, whenever you're trying to reconstruct a country like that, particularly when you have guerrillas fighting against you, terrorists fighting against you, that's a problem. But when you say that someone says that, you know, the war was wrong, the alternative was to leave Saddam in there, to leave Saddam funding other terrorist groups, to leave him in there with all of the tools of a terror state that he had, and that was simply unacceptable. The world changed after 9/11. Prior to 9/11, we left dangerous countries alone. Now they've come after us, and we're going after them.
Eric, Emily.
Oh, you know, Jerry, I just think the issue, having Donald Rumsfeld go to Iraq, it's just a sham. I mean, you know, he's saying, oh, we don't need any more troops there. You know, everything's under control. When, you know, John McCain and Democrats, so it's bipartisan. I mean, there's bipartisan agreement that more troops are needed to be in the country. That, you know, it's still very much out of hand. A lot of the Republicans, especially the fiscal conservatives, are getting cold feet now that they're realizing it's going to cost $1 billion a week or a month, whatever it is, in order to fund this effort. And I think that, you know, it's obviously didn't have any coherent post-war strategy.
Well, I think the very fact that Secretary of State Colin Powell and the military brass convinced the president this week to go to the UN and seek international assistance in Iraq is a fact that, you know, it shows that Rumsfeld didn't have a post-war plan that would adequately deal with all the forces that are going on over there.
But being Secretary of Defense, is he supposed to have a post-war plan?
He said he could do it.
That should come then to the State Department, which he actually, in the soundbite, said this week that now, you know, he welcomes the State Department, but the UN, that's what he said. He welcomes the UN and others coming in now. We're not fighting there. Patrice?
What's frightening to me in this post-war environment is we have actually created a situation in Iraq which is much more dangerous than it was before the war. We have created a situation where we have complete chaos, and now Al-Qaeda, the reports in the Washington Post today, indicate that Al-Qaeda is creating an actual front in Iraq. We have no evidence that there was any link between Saddam Hussein or Iraq and Al-Qaeda before. Today, with this situation of complete chaos and lack of control, we clearly have Al-Qaeda active in Iraq.
Let's talk to some people. Let's talk to, I think it's Charles in Centerville.
Yes, I have two quick questions, if I could. The first, can anybody on the panel explain to me what is mainstream America? That always kills me when people say, well, mainstream America wants this, and it always seems to be the profile of somebody sitting out in the Midwest somewhere when most of the people are populated in the cities in the Northeast, and they don't want anything that the people out in the lifestyle is so much different than the people out in the Northwest. It seems to me that the mainstream America would be your urban cities and your cities with most of the population.
Yeah.
And my second question is for the...
Hold your second question. Let's get the first question first. Okay, Nick?
The mainstream America is really 40% of the population are the urban Democrats, basically, and 40% of the population are the Midwestern Republicans, basically. So mainstream America, when politicians talk about it, is the 20% of undecided voters that swing in the middle. So really, that's mainstream America. The politicians know how you're going to vote, Charles. The politicians know how those guys out in the Midwest are going to vote. The only people they're worried about are soccer moms and elderly. So this is how your government's run.
Jim Pomeroy.
Yeah, look, the mainstream Republicans are in the mainstream. Being in the 8 o'clock the 8 o'clock hour, I tripped over my tongue a little earlier.
Would you rewind the majority, that tape and play it again.
The majority of people still support President Bush.
You
President
didn't
Bush
say
policies.
That, Jim.
That's what I meant to say earlier, but it's very, very early.
You said mainstream Republicans are mainstream. That's what you said. Steve, will you play the tape back?
The Freudian slip.
I'm going back to sleep.
You know, Jerry, I think when Jim makes his remark about mainstream America and with regards to Howard Dean, he's probably talking about his support of issues like civil unions and whatnot, which don't necessarily have majority support, but these are issues that are visionary, that push our country forward, And if you think about going back to the 60s and whatnot, you know, there were folks who opposed interracial marriage. Well, and, you know, we are a better society for breaking down those barriers.
The person in that position, you know, from a marketing standpoint, I'm better at that than politics. I would simply say that if you want your point to get over, then you say mainstream America says, well, we eat apples. And
yeah.
And that's what it about it all amounts to. And the media has picked up that it sounds good. You know, when Bush, for instance, President Bush stands before the military and speaks, he says, mainstream America supports my point of view. Whereas Daschle will say, well, mainstream, so it's understandable, we have mainstream. Your second question, sir.
To the Republican representative on the panel, I'm really curious. You know, when we first started out, we were going to go over and get Ben Loudon. And I wondered why did they think they could get Ben Loudon out of the mountains over there? But we couldn't even get the bomber out of our own Appalachian mountains over here.
All right. Thank you very much, sir, for your call.
If we had brought the same force to bear, I think we would have. But look, you have to go after him just because it is difficult to go after somebody.
You're not as peppy today. Is this CNN poll disturbing you?
No, we need more coffee. Look, you know, we have to go after Bin Laden. That is a national imperative. We have to go after Al Qaeda. That is a national imperative, and that is something that all parties should agree on. I think we simply disagree on how we do it. Going into Iraq, if Al Qaeda wants to mass in Iraq, then we're going to get them there. I'd rather fight them, have them fought there, than have them fought in New York and in the Pentagon again.
There's more Al Qaeda in Iraq now than there was before the war. I mean, there were fundamentalists in Iraq before we went in and created all this instability.
Do you want
now
Saddam
they're burning
back?
Liquor stores,
Patrice.
And women can't go out uncovered.
Al Qaeda is not an isolated group. Simply in Iraq, and we can go in and drop bombs and get them. Al Qaeda is dispersed throughout the world. They have now a more active presence in Iraq than they did before, but they are in many other areas of the world, every country probably dispersed throughout.
Nick?
Jim's pretty accurate on that. We do disagree on how to attack Al Qaeda. I think that we should attack them by finding them, and Jim thinks we should attack them by running off to attack us. Completely separate country that doesn't support them.
In case you're just joining us, folks, this is the first Sunday politics, as we call it, our political debate. Each month we do this to look at the issues that certainly we all hear about around the water fountain at work or at the dinner table, whichever. Didn't that sound so Norman Rockwell around the dinner table with the picket fence? Anyway. Our panelists are Nick Sawalk, Libertarian, Republican Jim Pomeroy, Emily Loeffler, Independent, Green Party Eric Michaels, as well as Democrat Patrice McKinney. And the gentleman who called to say that we are very unfair, that is diversity all the way. I mean, we can't be any fairer than that. But I tell you, Jennifer is in Herndon, and she wants to have a part of the action. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine.
Good. I have a couple of comments to make, and then I have a question.
All right.
You were just talking about the demographics of who's going to vote for what, and you know that the urban voters are going to go Democrat. The Midwestern Republicans will go for Bush. I'm one of those people in the middle. I live in a suburb. I'm a mom. My kids don't play soccer. They play baseball. But I'm one of those people that you were referring to as they don't know where they're going, and I wanted to let you know that I'm in the Howard Dean section of the Democrats. And I attend the meetups and have been active with the campaign. And I just want to let you know the wide, diverse group of people that I've come in contact with over the past 6 months, from 91-year-old longtime Republican Navy veterans to, young moms juggling staying home with their kids and for the first time getting active in politics. And I wanted to ask Patrice what she thinks it is that draws such a diverse and formerly inactive group of people towards Howard Dean.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call, Patrice.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer. I think
you didn't call Jennifer before the show.
Howard Dean appeals to a broad spectrum of people because Howard Dean is a candidate that is defying being labeled. He is running an issues-based campaign.
But who is he? I mean, you know, all of a sudden, Howard Dean is in the news, and it's like the others running on the Democratic ticket, whatever they are. The only person I know is Gephardt, but the rest of them, and of course Lieberman. But after that, Who are they?
But, Jerry, isn't that important? In less than a year, this guy has come from absolute, well, relative obscurity to being, you know, in the highlight of the national attention. Imagine what he can do within another year.
Yeah, but that's the same thing about George Bush. He came out of, I mean, we knew he was
we
a governor.
We knew who George Bush was before,
yeah, he, was a governor.
But, you know, before he hit Washington.
Howard Dean's, you know, a governor. Howard Dean has, you know, run a strong campaign, and the Internet has caught fire. And there's always a taste out there for insurgent campaigns. Look at John McCain last time. Howard Dean's the flavor of the month on this one, and I think with this weak field of candidates, he might make it. I mean, it's a very weak field.
Howard Dean is the only major party candidate that is successfully articulating an anti-war position, and he is tapping into resentment across the board, across mainstream America, against George Bush and the way he's driving this country. And that one issue is where his support comes from, and my biggest fear is that his support will fizzle just like John McCain's will, with campaign finance reform, and he won't actually make the nomination.
All right. Telephone number 301-230-0980, #980 in the Verizon Wireless System. I have lines open at 34 minutes past 8 o'clock here on Metro Talk from Clear Channel Radio in Washington, Big 100 and Sports Talk 980. I'm Jerry Phillips, and our panelists, of course, the experts, who are the political experts representing the various parties, such as Patrice McKinney, we welcome, Democrat, along with Eric Michaels, Green Party, Emily Leffler, Independent, Republican Jim Pomeroy, and Nick Sawak, who is the Libertarian. They're here as they spread out their thoughts and opinions on the various issues of the month. 301-230-0980, #980 on Verizon. Let's go to Morris in Silver Spring.
Hi, Jerry. Hi, pal.
Fine.
Interesting couple points, Jerry, and that to Jim Parmley, perhaps he could recommend this to George Bush, that in light of the statistics of more Americans dying after the declaration of the end of hostilities, perhaps we should redeclare hostilities and cut down on American casualties.
Well, I'll tell you, if we were to crack down like, you know, we could, the problem then is you have the population getting resentful about the crackdown. We are trying to walk the line on that one.
Yeah,
and
but Jim, he asks a very important question. You can't dance around the American casualties right now. What is it, almost 260 that have died since the war ended?
Which is about 120 more than died during the war. And the other point is that Republicans and other people make this grand speech about stamping out terrorism wherever it is. And what it seems to me is that we stamp out terrorism wherever we think we can get away with doing it. You know, we haven't done a lot to Syria. We tiptoe with Saudi Arabia. We're not really saying a whole bunch to Iran, but it was easy and popular because we built up such resentment and enmity towards Saddam Hussein in Afghanistan, so it was easy to go get them. But you can't go get terrorism on 14th and Columbia Road and ignore it at 14th and Park Road.
Okay.
Well, I'll give you a simple example. One of the reasons that it's important is it's made the rest of the area much calmer. One of the reasons Bin Laden has been saying that America was so evil was because we had troops in Saudi Arabia. Well, now that they were only there to protect Saudi Arabia from Iraq, so now that Iraq has been taken care of, those troops have come out. Syria is much more cooperative now that we've taken out Iraq. I think it's been a good thing overall.
Genevieve in Fairfax, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
I don't know, Genevieve, is that French?
Yes, it is.
Norman, it is French, right? I don't know if you want to talk to this crowd or not.
Well,
go ahead. I don't know how people got things against the French people. You know, come on.
I
like French ladies, you know.
I
like French wine.
I like freedom fries.
Oh,
I'm sorry, that's an embarrassment to the United States that we ever even came up with that. That's horrible, and I'm not French. In fact, I'm a registered independent, and I'm a mom, so I think I probably fall into that.
You're mainstream America.
You got it. What I wanted to call on was a predilection I'm seeing in the Republican Party. Remember, I'm an independent. I have voted both ways. That, you know, they make these blanket statements, and then they take on a life of their own. Like, you know, I know you said earlier that you were half asleep and you made the comment that Bush won the popular vote. You know, Gore won the popular vote, excuse me. You know, and if the Supreme Court hadn't shown its partisan politics, who knows what the situation would have been with our presidency right now. And I'm getting really sick to death of the Republicans doing that. You know, Bush in the State of the Union makes a comment that's a blatant lie, that is dead wrong, and then he just goes, ah, oh, gee, shucks, sorry I did it. And we're supposed to accept that and think that that's okay. Well, I'm middle American, I'm telling you, it's not okay. And I'd like to have a comment from the Republican Party candidate there. Not the candidate, but the gentleman representing the
Republican Party. Well, he is a candidate, too. Everyone's slipping up today.
Yeah. I'd really like to know why you think that it's okay to tell us blatant lies, blatant untruths that you know at the time are wrong, but still spout them. Your party does it all the time. I have not heard the Democrats doing this.
Well, I don't. I don't think there's any.
Thank you very much, Genevieve.
I don't think there's any lying going on. I was responding to. We were all, you know, batting around these poll numbers, and I was meaning to say the Republicans, the majority of Republicans, majority of Americans that support President Bush. So yeah, we all make flubs on the show, but I think when you look,
Jim,
at the mass weapons of mass destruction.
Excuse me, Jim. That's not what she asked.
Okay.
She said, "Why the Republicans continue to make false statements.
On what?
She wasn't talking about the panel.
On
yet.
What, though?
She's talking about
weapons of
the
mass destruction. 16 words.
And I think if we go back to that, that's an example of people saying, well, the president lied. He did not lie. Those 16 words are absolutely correct. We had learned that this had happened, and it turns out it hadn't, haven't found it yet, but he was acting on good faith based on the intelligence services of a number of
Tony Blair.
Yes. So England. I mean, what are you supposed to do? You know, you look at these things. These points look accurate. There's still a long way to search. It's certainly easy to hide those weapons.
Let's do this real quick, guys, because we're going to move to our next topic.
Jim, why don't you tell me what the meaning of is? Okay. I mean, the Republicans have been dancing around, you know, playing with words, lies, deception, misleading. You know, the fact of the matter is, I hope that you guys sit there and keep on doing what you're doing, because it's this kind of smugness than, you know, just ignoring the fact that millions of Americans are losing jobs, that hundreds of Americans have died in Iraq, and no one in the administration is even confronting that fact with the public. And, you know, I hope that you guys keep on sitting, you know, in your high seat, having campaigned on this platform of integrity, bringing integrity back to the office. Well, you know what? Keep on bringing that integrity back to the office, and, you know, we'll say goodbye in 2004.
If you're just joining us, that was Emily Leffler, who is an independent, along with Jim Pomeroy, Republican, Nick Sidewalk, Libertarian, Eric Michaels of the Green Party, and Patrice McKinney, Democrat. Craig in Bowie, Maryland. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a complicated point that probably ties in with Iraq and your. I heard about the plug for the vouchers next.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, and they both go to this. I think, like, people who've been to college, and mostly everyone on the radio has, rarely speak that the public is often undereducated and misinformed. And take Iraq, for instance. A person cannot make a serious argument and say, you know, there's good on both sides. For instance, it's good that Saddam is out of power, but that doesn't make it good that the war happened. But you can't make that point because it's too complicated for many people to understand. For instance, like, to bring it close to home, when we had the sniper last year, we could have shut down Maryland, Washington, and Virginia, did a sweep, cleaned out thousands of guns, thousands of criminals, caught the sniper, and then someone could say, now, are you telling me you're not for cleaning the streets of thousands of guns and getting the sniper and the public would go along with that, I'm sure. But then someone, the educator, would say, but yeah, there's another good that we're giving up, which would be our civil
rights. Craig, hold your point. I'm going to get Joe in on this so that we can kind of climax this segment, because we want to go to the vouchers. Joe in Arlington, Virginia, you heard what Craig is saying, and Craig hung up. But anyway, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I kind of had a different point. I just wanted to point out, I mean, I think some of your panel there is kind of treating the Americans like a bunch of idiots. When they beat up on Bush in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, do you really think that people are not aware that one of the primary reasons we have this big problem with terrorism is 8 years of neglect of the Clinton administration? I mean, do you think Americans don't know that?
They had 8 years to build up their organization.
Of course.
They had been committing terrorist acts around the world.
People know this was dumped into Bush's lap, and they're going to give him a lot of leeway. So for all your left-wingers there who've beaten up on Bush, I mean, give it a rest.
Thank you for calling, sir.
I've brought up this point before, and I'd like to bring it up again. You know, we've seen the photographs of Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein 20 years ago, when the Republicans were in office, we knew that he was gassing the Kurds, and we were selling them weapons and giving them money for anthrax and all this stuff. But they were our friends then. Now, you know, there's that span of 8 years where, I mean, that's just ridiculous.
But it's like Schwarzenegger says, it's about today. And today, attacking Iraq has galvanized the al-Qaeda movement. It's galvanized the terrorist movement and said, look, we are not afraid to go in and beat up on an Islamic country, which wasn't even Islamic. Okay. It was socialist. But
my dear friends, there is an interesting thing happening here in the District of Columbia. Voters voted against having any type of a voucher program, some say. Eleanor Holmes Norton, congresswoman for the District of Columbia, actually opposes any kind of a voucher program for the District of Columbia. Well, there are those who say in the shape of the D.C. public schools, they need vouchers to help many, many poor kids, as well as kids that aren't necessarily completely poor, go to private schools. It all centers around the word choice. The House of Representatives, according to this Washington Post article on September the 6th, that's Saturday, narrowly approved the nation's first federally funded school voucher plan yesterday. That was on Friday, endorsing a 5-year pilot program for at least 1,300 children in the district, in which supporters call shock treatment for the city's struggling public educational system. This would mean that the Republican-backed measure would award private tuition grants worth up to $7,500 per student starting next year. Anybody like to comment on that? Okay, Patrice.
Okay, giving $7,500 per student for private school education means siphoning off $11,000 per student for public school education. I'm not sure that that kind of shock treatment underfunding the school system is one that's really going to benefit the system in the long run.
So Patrice is pointing out that we have $3,500 in overhead that we're unnecessarily spending in this system that produces failures and dropouts by the score.
Nick's right. That means if we're only giving him $7,000 in the voucher and it costs $11,500 to teach him in the public schools, that's $3,500 saved, which can be put in to help the other children.
And
in the
children
schools.
Might learn. Whoa, let's not do that. The thing about it is Congress has had a long history of messing with D.C. politics, from the vote on medical marijuana that Bob Barr spiked twice, from all of these things, from the home rule cult. The board that ran D.C. There was a needle exchange. Right. Congress does this all the time, and it's probably going to go through. It's just lucky this time that it'll actually help little kids learn. So for once, their meddling might work.
The Washington Woo-hoo! Post editorial supports the fact that this would be good for D.C. schools. But there are those who say that money should be turned over to public schools. If you really want to do something, hire some good teachers and also try to reform the public schools.
Siphoning money away from an ailing system is not going to help the system.
They've done such a damn fine job with the money they have, haven't they? Let's give them more.
The fact of the matter is that there's folks in the House who wouldn't support this in their own state, voted against it for their own state, such as one of the folks out from California, but thought it was good enough for D.C. Feinstein, thank you. Dianne Feinstein wouldn't support it in her own state, but thought it was good enough for D.C. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to sit there and say, yes, we know the public schools are awful. We know that they're not doing what they're supposed to do. So let's just give them money to send them somewhere else rather than fix the problem.
Well, here's a gentleman on the line who has an insight to this whole thing. Don Soifer, who is executive vice president of the Lexington Institute on School Vouchers, which is a think tank. Don, what's the think tank? Left, right, or what?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me. We're a free market think tank, I guess. Okay. You probably say right.
All right. Go right ahead.
Well, super. I've been a D.C. resident myself for 14 years and done my best to get as good a sense and spend as much time with public school kids as I could. And I don't need to tell your guests some of the conditions that are being found, and certainly not all, but many of the D.C. public schools, particularly the secondary schools, the people who pulled this plan together, which includes significant input from the mayor and from the president of the school board,
which most of the people in D.C. disagree with. Go ahead.
That might well be. And there's a whole lot of learning to do with vouchers. And frankly, I think a lot of what most people in D.C. have learned about vouchers, they've learned from the signs on the sides of buses and the radio ads that both sides have been bombarding the airwaves with. And there hasn't been a whole lot of constructive discussion of the good that can come out of these things.
Right. Let me ask you a question, Don. Why D.C.? Why is D.C. the, what you call, the initiation ground?
I think whether or not people in D.C. disagree with them, Mayor Williams and Peggy Cooper Kafritz and Kevin Chavis had a whole lot to do with that, absolutely.
That's not my question. My question is, why is D.C. picked to be the proving ground for a voucher program backed by Republicans as a part of their national agenda?
Well, backed by Republicans and backed by many Democrats. D.C., for instance, on test scores, like the NAEP, the National Assessment Test, D.C. test scores are consistently not only one of the worst in the nation in terms of states, but when you compare them with other major cities, they're absolutely, some of the lowest test scores.
Well, just recently a study came out showing that D.C. was very much below all other school systems in the nation.
Uh-huh.
So that's understandable. But the question is still, why couldn't this program be kicked off in some other state or place when D.C. has no power to fight the Congress that's pushing it? That's my question. And that's not my question. That's the question that comes from the community or from the public.
Well, I think it's incorrect to say that the public of D.C. is resoundingly, or certainly, as you would say, unanimously against vouchers. There's been a lot of pressure put on by groups like D.C. Parents for School Choice. I've been to forums all over the city. I've been to debates at Howard University where they make a dramatic presence, and they make their case certainly known. And let's not forget, I mean, the mayor and the president of the school board and the chairman of the education committee on the D.C. Council all played a big part in crafting this plan. I think that certainly contributes.
Yeah, but not Linda Kropp. She's the chair of the D.C. Council. You're talking about Kevin
Chavis, who's the chair of the education committee on the D.C. Council.
Right, who hasn't done very much with that committee. He can't get it together on school lunches.
Jerry, I have a question for the caller. There have actually been voucher programs that have been tested in Wisconsin, and I wonder if the caller is familiar with those and mm-hmm. any of the outcomes as far as how those students have
worked out.
Yeah, how is that compared?
What about that, Don?
Sure. Well, the voucher programs that are in Wisconsin and also in Cleveland, Ohio, are really the two study cases that we have to work on.
And what are the results?
Well, I think obviously both sides can use numbers to their own effect, as you know well from the think tank community. But there's been some pretty compelling studies based on those, and also on if you look at the private voucher results. Where particularly African American kids, and particularly this is means tested kids, this is Title I, this is disadvantaged kids, do substantially better once they've moved to the school of their choice, and once you need to control for things like any kid who's beginning a school year, their very first year in a new school is just not going to do as well by virtue of the fact that they've got a whole lot of adjusting to do. And you've also got to acknowledge that just any kids whose parents care enough about them to take such an active role in their education as to move them to a different school, and in many cases to have to transport the kid to the school and do everything it takes to wait in line, it's going to do better just by virtue of fact of that.
Okay.
But allowing for those factors, the data for the effectiveness of school choice for those kids has been dramatic, as well as the effect on improving all of the public schools. And to me, this might very much be about the 2,000 or 1,800 kids that are going to benefit and be able to take the vouchers in D.C. But the real question, the larger question, is as your panel has suggested already, what that's going to mean for the value of D.C. schools at large.
Okay.
And based on the experiments that we've seen with vouchers already, those schools that have had the greatest threat of losing kids to vouchers have had the greatest incentive to improve, and that's where we have seen the greatest of improvements,
sir.
And that's what we're hoping to see here.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.
Now, he presents a very interesting argument here because, number one, I just want to correct him on one thing. Title I was not only for African Americans. Title I was a program that actually came out of the schools during the
70s.
Thank you. I wanted to say the 60s, but the 70s. And it was in the structure of the D.C. schools that you had Title I schools. A good example of that was the Cadoza School, many of the schools in Northwest Washington and Southeast. And many of those kids came out, and they did do better because monies were poured into a certain number of schools. I'm thinking about Anthony Boyne, I think, down in Southwest. But those schools really did improve, and the kids did improve. Which certainly questions his argument.
At
the outside, right.
Yeah.
But the question, the argument, if why take monies from the public schools, well, what you're saying, Patrice, if you can have Title I schools that prove the same thing.
I want to make two quick points, Jerry. First of all, in answer to your question, the reason D.C. was picked is it's the only jurisdiction the federal government actually has control over.
Right.
So it's the only place that Congress can go meddling in this sort of thing. The second thing is, much as it would be great if, you know, this did affect all the public schools, and I think it will affect them for the better, it's about the kids. I don't really care about the school system. If I'm, you know, a father or mother in D.C. whose child is failing in a public school, I could care less. I want my child to learn. And I think that all of us should want those children to learn. And if they cannot learn in the public school, then Who can stand up and tell me that we should keep them there to save, quote-unquote, the system?
Okay. Patrice, you want to answer that, or Emily?
Well, I think we're talking about saving all the kids, not just saving the 2,000 kids with the greatest potential whose parents, you know, care enough to put them in another place. I mean, as the caller pointed out, you know, we're taking folks whose parents are involved out of the system. We're taking kids with great potential out of the system. We're taking money out of the system. We're sending it to private schools. We're sending, this also means we're still sending taxpayer money to faith-based schools, which
right.
is another constitutional issue.
So you want to take...
And we're talking about preserving the system in the long term for kids, for our kids, and their grandkids.
So you want to tell the mother of that kid right now that her kid has to be held back so that you can save your system?
Yeah, but
we're talking about giving them money...
Right.
To improve the system now,
yeah,
not tomorrow.
We can't
tomorrow.
Afford it. Hold tight, guys.
Eric,
sure, a good example of helping the system would be Banneker Senior High School, which has really excelled beyond, I mean, test scores above average at Banneker Senior High School. Is that an example as to how money should be put back in the system, or should it be privatized, go to Catholic schools and to other religious schools as well as other private schools?
Well, you know, I'm as big a supporter of any of paying teachers more money. I think that teachers, you know, in order to attract...
if you have
folks,
good teachers.
Yeah, exactly, to get quality teachers and to pay them what they're worth. I also think that this situation in D.C., although I disagree with the way that it's gone about, I think D.C. should be able to be more autonomous. I think that a $7,500 voucher, in comparison to, say, some of the earlier Republican proposals of like a $2,000 voucher, which is absolutely worthless, presents an interesting case. And let's, you know, I'd be really interested in seeing the results of this and looking at it from an empirical standpoint.
Tim and Lanham, you have about 20 seconds. I hate to do this to you, but this timing.
That's okay. I just want to make a brief comment and just offer my humble opinion. Everyone talks about the system this, the system that. Not only are the kids the most important part of the system, but a very big part of the system are the parents. If the parents would do their job as the parents and make sure that the kids apply themselves and put pressure on the kids to learn what they should learn, it puts pressure on the teachers to teach them what they need to learn to be successful adults. So as far as sending the money to private schools, that's fine and dandy. If I can afford, I'd send my kids to private schools in a heartbeat. You know what I'm saying? But it's up to the parents to make sure the teachers are prepared as adults when they reach that age where they don't have to, you know, settle for $5 an hour jobs, you know, this and that. But I just want to throw that out there. It's up to the parents to make sure the students are prepared when they go to school to learn. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you very much. And let's end it on that note. Folks, yes, no. I got about 20 seconds here. Eric Mickelson, who is the Green Party. John Hinckley, should he be... freed?
Is he being freed, or is he going to be granted?
Well, he's going to be. Well, that's freedom. I mean, you know,
he's going to be allowed. Right. Yeah, visitation.
Yes or no?
You know, I think that
yes
his
no?
situation. No, no.
Okay. from the Democrats, Patrice McKinney.
Nope, it's a slippery slope.
No.
Emily.
No.
No.
Oh, sure. Send them to my neighborhood. Go ahead.
Oh, my goodness. There we go. Thank you very much to all of our panelists this morning. I want to thank those who certainly joined us this morning. Nick Sawalk, Jim Pomeli, Emily Leffler, Eric Mickles, and Patrice McKinney. See you next month, guys, and come with your baseball bats. After all, everybody needs a baseball bat. Thank you to those who helped to put it together. Steve Solomon is our technical producer. Daisha Klecklick is our administrator. Quentin Jackson, public affairs assistant. Written and produced by yours truly, Jerry Phillips. Metro Talk is a WBIG, WTEM, Sports Talk 980 public affairs presentation. From Clear Channel Radio in Washington, D.C., it's going to be a gorgeous day. Get out, appreciate it. Much peace, much love. WBIG.